The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled How to Stop Worrying, is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmos Shlomo Ben Moshe, Mr. Sam Zuroff, and Mordechai Ben Sender Chaim, the Esther Bas Yitzchok, Mr. and Mrs. Max and Esther Barrison, Aleihem Hashalom of blessed memory.
First, good evening, and thank you very much for coming. It comes in many forms, and it has many names: fear, worry, anxiety. But its effect is all the same. It steals the joy from life, prevents a person from reaching his or her potential, and can often totally paralyze a person, forcing the person to live a life of inaction and frustration. These fears and worries know no boundaries and respect no individual. It touches people from all walks of life, irrespective of status or intelligence. In fact, some of the world's most famous and brilliant people were constantly plagued by fears and worries that wreaked havoc on their lives. The pity of all of this is that in most cases it could have been easily prevented or cured. It is the consensus of the mental health community that for the most part, worries and anxieties are based on erroneous suppositions and attitudes, and compounded by a fertile imagination that makes even a remote possibility of the feared event a probability, and every probability a virtual certainty. In the words of the noted psychiatrist and pioneer in psychotherapy, Dr. William James, and I quote, "The greatest discovery of all times is that man can alter his life by altering his attitude of mind," end quote. In this lecture, we will share with you an attitude of mind based on thousands of years of Jewish experience and learning. Alone or in conjunction with other forms of therapy, this attitude will greatly help you to conquer your worries and fears and substitute them with hope and confidence. Not only will you experience relief, but you will also begin to experience the pleasure that comes from having a spiritual outlook on life. Before we explore the Jewish approach to worry and fear, I would like to talk a little about the different kinds of things we worry about and review some of the most common ways that therapists deal with worry. Worry can roughly be classified into two kinds. One, which we will call rational worry, is the kind you may experience while you're walking alone in the middle of the night in a high-crime, drug-infested area. You've been driving and your car stalls. You're in the middle of Harlem. It's similar to the fear that a soldier may experience when he receives the order, "Fix bayonets and charge." Not only is worry an appropriate feeling in that kind of situation, but by making the person more sensitive to the dangers all around, those feelings may very well save his life. There's a second kind, which we will call irrational worries. For instance, one scenario is that you have an important appointment tomorrow. You're going to be interviewed for a new position. The night before, you can't sleep. Keep on thinking, what happens if I'm rejected? What happens if I make a fool of myself at the interview? It's no use. I'm probably going to fail this interview like I failed all the rest. You may become so distraught that you cancel the interview, rationalizing that it wouldn't have worked out anyway. That's one possible scenario. Another scenario is that you're on an elevator. As the elevator rises higher and higher, you're gripped with the fear of the elevator cable snapping and being hurtled to a terrible death. You break out into a cold sweat, feel nauseous, and are barely able to make it to your destination. Both these scenarios, the job interview and the elevator scene, we would call irrational worries. That means that most rational people would not experience a deep sense of worry in those situations. Perhaps concern. You have an interview, after all, there is a possibility of failure. But not real fear or anxiety. How do you deal with irrational worry? There are actually three basic approaches to alleviate worry, fear, or anxiety, the kind that we would call irrational. They're best classified as 1, the therapy that focuses on the past and the memories that are buried in the subconscious mind. 2, the therapy that focuses on the present and being able to change one's present behavior. And 3, the therapy that focuses on the future, radically changing one's outlook on life. Since it's been proven that the first two therapies, the therapy of the past and the therapy of the present, have helped thousands or millions of people, and it could well be an option that you decide to take, I would like to briefly discuss some of the strengths of each one of these psychotherapies. Probably the best known is a psychoanalytical method that was developed by Sigmund Freud and his disciples. It was subsequently borrowed and modified by others, but it really remains the standard of psychotherapy. I'd like to just give you a little brief history of it. You should appreciate it and possibly, if you deem it necessary, opt for it. Towards the end of the 19th century, Sigmund Freud's mentor and early associate in Vienna, Dr. Joseph Breuer, discovered that when people unburdened themselves to a therapist, revealed their fears and the underlying problems, the events that created them, in other words, they speak about their past, they speak about the childhood that molded them and shaped them, they very often experience a catharsis, a cleansing, a sense of relief. This, by the way, is the very basis of psychotherapy. The theory behind this is that once the unconscious mind is no longer burdened, and these deep-seated fears and memories are brought out in the open, they will automatically dissipate on their own. Freud and his followers expanded Dr. Breuer's basic idea by claiming that all or most irrational fears are a result of the forgotten conflicts and fantasies that the person experienced in childhood and presently reside in the unconscious mind. Unless these forgotten fears are brought out in the open, according to Dr. Freud, the person is often doomed to experience one form of fear or another. In other words, according to Dr. Freud, the reason that we worry, at least irrationally so, is based on experiences of our childhood. The nature of these unconscious fears, I mean, what events will trigger all this worry, and how they manifest themselves in regular life is, of course, a matter of disagreement among the various schools of psychotherapy. Dr. Freud's vision of the conflicts of a human being, of course, are a subject of great controversy. I'd like just to share with you, understand why it was so controversial. A case that Dr. Freud published. This is a case study. It was the year 1909. There was a 5-year-old boy by the name of Hans. who refused to go out into the street for fear a horse might bite him. Freud felt that behind the fear was Hans's unconscious fear that his father would punish him by castration because of Hans's strong desire for his mother. In other words, Hans suffered from the Oedipus complex. But Hans, instead of manifesting this fear towards his father, according to Dr. Freud's interpretation, had subconsciously transferred the fear of his father towards the horse. Now, this transference is a major tenet of Freud's whole theory. By displacing his love of his fear and anxiety from his father to the horse, Hans avoided the object of his phobia and was able to love his father instead of fearing him. In other words, he really feared his father deep down. He couldn't bear to live with this conscious fear of his father. Therefore, he projected this fear onto some other object, and on the conscious level at least, was able to deal with his father. Freud's method of dealing with little Hans would be to explore the underlying Oedipus complex. He would use, if it would be an adult, would use free association, dream interpretation, and would try to get Hans to realize his basic conflict. A normal person listening to this theory, of course, would feel that Dr. Freud himself had serious conflicts. And that's why, of course, Dr. Freud was so controversial. Several of Freud's original followers left him, and they came up with other theories. Today, a psychotherapist who's not of the Freudian school, is not a psychoanalyst, would probably say that Hans was traumatized in an early age because he saw a horse biting someone. And that's what he's afraid of, not this complicated conflict. Accordingly, of course, it was this experience that caused the problem, and it would be important, therefore, in order for Hans to get relief, to sum up, dredge up the memories of this traumatic event so he could achieve catharsis. All of this is easier on paper, by the way, than really achieving. It's very, very difficult. But how do you dredge up childhood memories that are long forgotten? A person can come to a psychotherapist. He's 60 years old, 70 years old. A whole life is past him. Originally, Dr. Breuer's method of memory recall was through hypnosis. Freud himself found hypnosis cumbersome and developed his own method of free association, like the person, what are you thinking of? And if I tell you this, what do you think of? To release ideas in the mind that have been trapped. And of course, he used dream interpretation, which is one of his pioneering efforts. Hypnosis still remains a standard procedure amongst many therapists. This method, where the patient under hypnosis recalls and relives some experience buried in the recesses of his memory, is called regression therapy. By the way, there's an interesting form of therapeutic hypnosis and regression therapy that has far-reaching implications beyond anxiety relief. Some 10 years ago, Dr. Brian Weiss, then director of psychiatry at Mount Sinai Hospital in Miami, Florida, by sheer accident, discovered one of today's most innovative approaches in psychotherapy. A patient of his, which he calls Catherine, suffered from numerous phobias, like these irrational fears. Despite his efforts through conventional psychoanalysis and regression therapy to unearth childhood abuse and trauma, which he did, in other words, it did come out through therapy, she wasn't responding. She didn't experience relief. In other words, this idea of catharsis, that once these memories come out, you experience this relief, wasn't happening with Catherine. In one hypnotic session, he asked Catherine to go back in time to recall the incidents that was causing her so much grief. In other words, the person's under hypnosis, and they ask her, go back in time. She proceeded to recall under hypnosis traumatic events of past lifetimes or reincarnations that caused her her present anguish. In session after session, Catherine described past traumas that extended over many lifetimes, spanning thousands of years. In the process, she was permanently cured of her phobias. She achieved catharsis. Dr. Weiss wrote up this case in his now famous book, Many Lives, Many Masters. We will discuss this book further on in this lecture, but this procedure has now become standard amongst many therapists who've achieved startling results trying to unearth memories of past lives. The philosophical implication of this therapy, remembering past lives, by the way, are enormous. If a person can recall past lifetimes under hypnosis and receive the same kind of relief that one experiences under normative hypnosis, it presents a compelling case for the actual existence of those past lifetimes and those memories. In other words, it would seem that those memories are real. We can't prove it, of course. But it would seem that there is some truth to these memories. If we can remember a past lifetime, that in a sense means that our memory is stored in a place other than our brain. Because our brain only can store memory that the brain experiences. How can it store memories of a lifetime in a totally different body? In a sense, if this is assuming this to be true, it's saying that our personality and consciousness is actually spiritual in nature. It's not just a product of the electrical and chemical workings of our brain. It means that we may live one lifetime here and yet can subsequently be reborn in another period of time to another family. Accordingly, it would seem evident that our personality never truly dies, but merely leaves this body at death for a new phase of existence. We'll speak more of this later in the lecture, but it's interesting that this whole new field of psychotherapy, in a certain sense, invalidates much of Freud's view of what man is all about. Let's apply this approach, and it's not necessarily the Freudian approach, but the idea of catharsis. In other words, talking, going over your childhood, going over those events that shaped your life, and how a therapist would deal with your irrational worries. In other words, let's say the job interview. The therapist would go back in time about your childhood. Perhaps the parents of this person who was so worried were parents themselves that were traumatized. Very nervous people, demanding. The child was under tremendous pressure. The failures that this child experienced were not supported by the parents, but were actually translated into the fact that the child does not measure up. If the parents were physically or verbally abusive to the child, they all made, of course, a very deep impression. So instead of having a rational view of the person's worries, that really, you know, failure is nishkefelach, you know, everybody fails. And if you don't pass in a job interview, it's not the end of the world. There's another interview down the road. The person takes it so personally. His ego is so vulnerable that every criticism and every failure, really, in it, he hears echoes of the parents who keep on telling you, you just don't measure up. Why can't you be as good as this person or your brother or I was when I was a child? Of course, a true Freudian would search for even deeper causes for this anxiety. In other words, just in short, how a therapist would attack irrational worries would be to go to the root cause and try to achieve catharsis. As you talk, as it comes out in the open, you see it as merely being irrational. You can deal with it. This is what we call the therapy of the past. And there are people that achieve dramatic results with this therapy. Not everyone. But for those who do achieve results, it's worth it all. There's a parallel to this idea of catharsis in Jewish life. I'm referring, one prime example, is vidui, the confession we make for our sins on Yom Kippur or other parts of the year. It's all familiar, say, Ashamnu, Bogadnu, Al-Chait. We verbally articulate our past, and it's part of the process of repentance, of changing. In other words, we make a commitment to change. We look back at our past with regret, but it's important to verbalize it, not just to keep it inside. I did this, I did that. We bring it out into the open. And according to many authorities, a part of the dynamics of vidui, when you make the confession, when you're standing in the synagogue in shul on Yom Kippur, is the idea of you see it. It's not just some vague memory. It's out in the open. You can deal with it. You can achieve a catharsis. Your life is a lot easier. That's one method. In other words, the method of achieving catharsis. There's another method. And the reason I'm going through this is because for many people, this is very effective. And one should really seriously consider the option if other means don't work. There's another method which we will call the therapy of the present. This is the behaviorist school of therapy. Those of that school don't focus on the root causes. They focus on the here and now. And they also, by the way, have an unusually high success rate. And again, just to appreciate this, and I'll just briefly go over this, it's important really to go a little to the history of this whole school. Very different than the Freudian school. The story of the behaviorist school really begins with Ivan Pavlov, who in the process of doing research on the digestive system discovered what became to be known as conditioned reflex. For his research on digestion, for which he eventually received a Nobel Prize in 1904, Pavlov needed to collect saliva from his laboratory animals, dogs. He did this by placing meat powder in the dog's mouth. He discovered that as soon as the dogs would see him, even before they smelled the meat powder, they would salivate. In other words, in their mind, they had associated he with the meat. So they didn't even smell the meat, they began to salivate. He then tried ringing a bell. In other words, before he gave them the meat powder, he rang a bell. And again, the same reaction occurred. They began to salivate because after a while they began to associate ringing the bell with the meat powder. This secondary reflex, in other words, salivating at the ring of the bell, is called conditioned reflex. In America, 1920, John B. Watson extended Pavlov's animal research into the study of human behavior. He took an 11-year-old boy by the name of Albert. What he did, of course, does not meet the ethical standards of today, as you'll see. He took this boy, who at that time was not afraid of white laboratory rats. He was frightened, though, of loud, sudden noises. So Whenever Watson showed the rat to Albert, he also made the loud, frightening noise. After a while, the mere sight of the rat, even without the loud noise, frightened him. In fact, he became frightened by any furry object, unless he extended this fear. A rabbit, a fur coat, a dog, even a mask of Santa Claus with a long white beard. In other words, Watson had succeeded in proving that humans act like Pavlov's dogs. 4 years later, psychologist Mary Cover Jones showed that conditioning can be used to remove fears. Just because it can create it, it can remove it. Peter, a child of almost three, feared rabbits. While looking at the rabbit in the cage and at a distance, Peter was given candy. Here, the feared rabbit was paired with pleasure of the candy. Within 6 weeks, Peter was gleefully playing with the rabbit. In other words, fear can be learned and fears can be unlearned. This is the basis of the behaviorist school of psychotherapy. Based on this principle and methods first described by Dr. Andrew Salter in the 1940s, who was one of the pioneers of this field, Dr. Joseph Walpe, during the 1950s, developed and tested the methods, now become standards in the field. Not attempting, as Freud did, to reason you out of your fear, provide you with insight, or uncover deep, unconscious conflicts, he developed a straightforward training procedure to respond, like little Peter, to situations that may have paralyzed you for years. Time does not allow us to go into greater detail into this method, but there are many good books that have been written on the subject. One I would highly recommend is Stop Running Scared by Dr. Herbert Fensterheim. In the case of the person who freezes before tests, the therapist, using this method, would gradually desensitize the person and condition him, like little Peter, to stop having these fears. The difference between these two schools of thought, one the very theoretical and one the very practical, is probably best illustrated by the following story. A patient came to a psychotherapist with a terrible problem. The patient couldn't sleep at night. As the patient would lay in bed, he felt that there was someone lurking under his bed. He would quickly go on all fours under the bed, take a look under the bed. There was no one there. But he reasoned perhaps the person had snuck out while he went down on the other side and when it was now on top of the bed. He quickly went on top of the bed. He wasn't there, but maybe he had gone down. So he kept on going down and up, down and up, down and up, the whole night. Poor fellow couldn't sleep and came to the psychotherapist. After hearing the story, the psychotherapist sympathized with the patient, said, "It's possible you'll receive a cure, but it'll take a while. You'll have to come 3 times a week for a year." "How much will this cost me, doctor?" "Oh, about $300 a session." I'll think it over." Needless to say, the patient did not go back to his therapist. A few months later, though, the therapist happened by chance to meet this fellow on the street. And he asked him, says, "You know, I haven't seen you. What happened to you?" He says, "Doctor, I'm cured." "Really? How did it happen? Who did it for you?" "It was my bartender. I went to the bar after I spoke to you. And I told my bartender my problem." And he said, "We'll fix you up in a jiffy." He says, "Go to the hardware store and buy yourself a saw. Cut down all the legs of your bed. No one will ever, and you know what? I don't fear, no one could be under my bed now." Again, the psychotherapist using Freudian's methods would deal with the root cause. The bartender had a different method. And this, in nature, is really the method of the behaviorist school. It's very practical. It does not deal with root causes. It trains you not to be afraid. There's another method. We dealt with dealing with root causes, uncovering them, expressing them. This is the idea of catharsis. We spoke about behavior modification. And by the way, behavior modification is central to Judaism itself. One of the great authorities of the Middle Ages, this is in 13th, 14th century Spain, was Rabbi Aaron of Barcelona. Rabbi Aaron, in understanding the rationale of many of the mitzvahs of the Torah, explains that man is a creature of habit. We are affected by the way we live. And that not only do we live because we think in a certain way, but because by the way we live, we begin to think differently. As it says in Hebrew, hergel nasa teva. It says habit becomes second nature. And therefore he rationalized many of the mitzvahs of the Torah as the habit of performing these things, even though you have no feelings, but conditions the person to feel a certain way. One prime example is davening, is prayer. Prayer is from the, and we're going to speak about this, prayer is from the heart. Prayer is expressing your feelings. Very often, we have no feelings. We're numbed. But yet, we go into a shul, we go into a synagogue and start praying. And from the very act of praying, even though we're not in the mood, we get into the mood. We're in the mood, we pray. By praying, we get into the mood. And so, to many of what we would look at in the Torah would be excessive, is really, at least according to the Chinuch, is really a means of behavior modification and changing the way you act and think by doing. There's a third method, and that's the idea of fostering a positive view of life. This is the therapy of the future. This Freudian's view, ability to achieve catharsis, or the behaviorist view of changing the way you respond to events, doesn't basically alter your outlook on life. But there's a philosophical approach to worry that really makes worry that if one has this philosophy of hope, many of what we would consider fears evaporate. And one of the wonderful things about this approach that we're going to deal with is not only does it deal with irrational fears, the fears that we just can't put our finger on, why do we act this way or that way, but deal with very rational fears. We have real fears of death. We have fear of ill health, of failing investments, of marital difficulties, disappointments in life. These are real fears. These aren't irrational fears. This is not like Hans, who's afraid, says when he sees a horse and is deathly afraid, or that a person has this phobia about elevators. These are real concerns. But how do you cope with these real fears on a day-to-day life way? The Freudian method and the behaviorist method are not going to help you. How to create a philosophy of hope and optimism to deal with worry is the subject of this lecture. And we've divided this lecture into 9 parts. Each part begins with a letter that spells out the acronym HAVE FAITH. It's hope, act, voodoo, excuses, fate, afflictions, intuition, Torah, and help. Before one enters any therapy, one has to be strongly motivated. If you want to help yourself, you have to want to help yourself. For Jews, it generally comes very easy. Jews are generally not satisfied with the status quo. I'd like to share with you a story that I've heard from the chief rabbi emeritus of the British Empire, Lord Emanuel Jacobovitz. He told me a very cute story about three people who came, each one came to a physician and were told they only have 3 months to live. One was an Irishman, one was a Frenchman, and one was a Jew. All of them shared the same disease. The pronouncement of the doctor was that there was no hope. Only 3 months. The media got hold of this story and interviewed each one of these patients. And they spoke to the Irishman and they asked him, "What are your plans for the next 3 months?" He says, "It's going to be a very busy 3 months." "So what are you going to do?" He says, "You know, my whole life I scrimped and saved. I was waiting for my retirement. I only have 3 months to live. There's nothing to save for. I'm going to empty out my bank account and really enjoy life." They interview the Frenchman. He says, "What are you going to do for the next 3 months?" "Oh, it's going to be a very busy 3 months." "You know, as a Frenchman, I was really an atypical Frenchman. I was really very straight-laced. Really, there's nothing to hold me back. I'm really going to enjoy myself for the next 3 months." And then they interview the Jew. And they ask them, "What are you going to do in the next 3 months?" "Oh, it's going to be a very busy 3 months. I'm looking for another doctor." In other words, as Jews, we are not satisfied with the status quo. That's why so many Jews are revolutionaries. Before we begin to study of how to rid ourselves of fear and worry, it would be worthwhile to keep in mind the words of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his first inaugural address. "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance." The H of have faith is hope. Very often, when we think of Judaism, we think of rituals. You do this or you do that. But the foundation of Judaism is really hope. That's what really it's all about. It's based, and everything that we do is based and is meant to foster a sense of trust. The whole Passover Seder, we go over every year, we bring our families together, we recount the events that happened so many thousands of years ago. And at the end, we say, "Lashona habo b'Yerushalayim," next year in Jerusalem. We just don't commemorate our past. We use it to strengthen our future. On page 2, I quote from the tens or hundreds of quotes we find in the Bible about the importance of hope. "And many are the sorrows of the evil, but the person that trusts in God shall be surrounded by kindness." According to the basic teachings of the Torah and the Talmud, not only is it important to have hope, but to the extent that we do have hope, we are helped. In other words, to the extent that we invite God in our lives, God is there. To the extent we shut Him out, He's not there. When we pray, what we are doing is articulating our hope. That's what really prayer is. We are expressing the fact we trust You. And here on paragraph B on page 2, There's a verse in Psalms, in Tehillim, which is interpreted by the Talmud. Hasha Chal Hashem Yehovcha. This is in Psalms 55. Throw your burden upon God, and He'll take care of you. That, in a sense, is one of the basic ideas of Judaism. You may think it's this ritual or that ritual doing this and that. This is what Judaism is all about. Creating a relationship with God. And even when you pray, and very often, you don't get an answer. It's important not to give up, to keep on praying. Because in the view of the Talmud, prayer helps. There's a fascinating study that was done in San Francisco a few years back. There were 393 patients that were taken, heart patients. And they were divided up randomly. The patients didn't know who was on one side of the list, neither did the physicians. Half were prayed for and half were not. In other words, they took just a random list of these 393 people, on what basis. And they had people pray for those on the list. The control group was not prayed for. And those that were prayed for were helped significantly. It was an amazing study. Again, every study has to be, one because a scientist, one could say, well, maybe it's just a freak occurrence. And of course, I don't know, again, because of other controlled studies into this thing, but it's a fascinating study. But basic to Judaism is the idea that prayer does help. We have a problem. We live in a modern era. It's almost a century and a half after Darwin published his book, Origin of the Species. The world does not think as it thought for thousands of years. We are people who doubt. And it's very hard to have the same hope and trust and faith that existed for so many thousands of years. I just briefly like to touch upon three areas that if one wants to find strength, one can truly find it. One is the miracle of the survival of the Jewish people. Frederick the Great of Prussia was one of the world's great generals, statesmen. He was the one who created Prussia from a minor state to a major power. He was a free thinker. He had many doubts. He once asked his personal chaplain, "Prove to me that there is a God." He answered in two words, "The Jews." The existence of the Jewish people throughout all their history and all their suffering, and the fact that their existence and their suffering is predicted by the Torah itself, is the greatest, according to Frederick the Great's chaplain, is the greatest proof of God's existence. You know, Josephus wrote some 2,000 years ago, this War of the Jews, that there's no nation on earth that has suffered like the Jews. Imagine what he would write if he would be alive today. And yet we're still here. We're here. We're connected. There's a wonderful community in Israel. Unthinkable. But yet, it shows something which is extraordinary. There's another area that one could find support. And that's the idea of near-death experiences. There's a fascinating, and I highly recommend reading the literature of what has been written up by the researchers, the doctors, who've interviewed the patients who've had these near-death experiences. the fact that these people have experienced virtually the same experience, this out-of-body experience, that they existed outside of their bodies, left their rooms, could able to come back and relate events that occurred in this world and in the next is amazing. Some of it is verifiable. This is an incident which I described in a class last year. But again, this is just one of many, and I highly recommend that one takes the time to either go to a bookstore or the library and get hold of these books. One story which was written by Raymond Moody, he was the primary researcher of the near-death experiences. And since his original book in 1975, there have been many other researchers who have gone into the field. He writes of a woman called June. June was a very sick woman. She was being operated on. And in the midst of the operation, June claimed that her consciousness left her body. For a while, she was in the operating room, hovering over her body, and got bored. You know, you've seen one operation, you've seen them all. And decided to go elsewhere. She left the room, went across the hall, and it was her consciousness, and went into the waiting room, where she saw her brother-in-law. I asked, "What are you doing here?" To which he replied, "It looks like my sister-in-law June's going to kick the bucket. So I think I have to stay around here, says, to be one of the pallbearers. I had to cut my business trip short." Evidently, June heard enough. She went back, at least this is the story she says. She re-entered her body. June survived the operation. And when her brother-in-law came to visit her in the recovery room, June told her, says, "Next time you go on a business trip, just don't worry about me. I'll just be fine." And it looked like the brother-in-law was going to have a near-death experience. So there's an abundant literature of people who've had these experiences. One part of this experience is they leave their body, go into another plane, experience a being who they describe as a being of light, who exudes warmth and love and care in a way that they've never experienced before in their lives. Those who've had this experience with the light come back transformed. In fact, this is the title of one of the many books on the field, Transformed by the Light. That people who've had this experience have been literally transformed. Their personality changes, their life changes, their goals in life change. To them, it's not merely a dream, it's a real experience. So again, if one wants to find faith, or a place that really is hope, I think a good place would be to start reading this literature. And the third is really looking at ourselves. We are composed of billions of atoms, trillions of atoms, which form organic compounds, which ultimately form the DNA in our cells, which is the code which every one of our cells is built. It's amazing. The simplicity and the genius and the complexity all at the same time is, one stands, I don't know if you've ever gone, you've seen the great sights of the world, the Grand Canyon, Yosemite. You just stand there in awe. If one looks at the DNA in every one of our cells, one stands in awe of the genius that created all of this. I remember, it's no longer current, but I remember as a little boy, there was a song, "I Believe." Some of you remember, "I believe for every drop of rain that falls, a flower grows." There was an era that belief and trust was part of our psyche. It was an era that worries took on a different dimension. the essence of the Jewish view of life is a view of hope. Despite all the suffering we've gone through, we're still here. And that body of light that these people without a body experiences have encountered is that love that's taking care of us every moment that we exist. That's the basis of the hope that we've lived for thousands of years. It's not easy to have faith, but if we cultivate it, not only will we live a relatively worry-free existence, and we're going to deal with this soon, but it just feels good. Unfortunately, what we've done through the mass migrations, because of the deprivations we've experienced, and we came to this country and we focused almost totally to establish ourselves materially, we've neglected the psychological and spiritual side of our nature, which is, for many of us, is really starved. But if one wants to know what is Judaism all about, Judaism is about hope. Judaism is about trust. There's a very cute story. I've said it in a previous lecture last year, and I'll share it with you again. It's just so cute and beautiful. But in a certain sense, it sums up a lot of what Jewish life is all about. We spoke about the Grand Canyon and its grandeur. Someone went to visit the Grand Canyon. And he was walking alone by the edge, looking here and looking there. And at one particular point, he was standing by the edge, looking down and down, and lost his footing and began falling. 50 feet down, the poor fellow caught hold of a tree that was growing on the side of the canyon and was holding on for dear life. He looked up. It was a sheer climb. It was impossible to climb up. And he looked down, and it was a mile down. And he started screaming for help like he never screamed before, but no one was there to help him. He happened to be in a deserted part of the canyon. And then he started to do something that he never did before. He started praying. And he prayed and he prayed and he screamed and he cried. And he says, if there's a God up there, please help me. And all of a sudden, a voice came from heaven. He says, I'm God and I'm going to help you. But one thing, I want you to show me that you really trust in me. He says, what is it? He says, I want you to let go. Let go? Yes, I want you to let go. And he looked down, it's a mile down. He looked up, it was 50 feet. And he looked up to heaven again and called out, hey, is there anybody else up there that can help me? I think that really summarizes our lives. We're very blessed. God's really there to help us. But sometimes we have to let go. We have to let go of our worries. We have to let go of those petty things that we thought this is going to be our salvation or that's going to be our salvation. And trust. And this is the idea, as we said in paragraph B on page 2, throw your peckle, throw your burden on God. The next A of have faith is act. We have faith, but we do act. We live in a real world. We're God's partner in this world. We have to act with prudence. We have faith. We have worries about our livelihood. But we don't sit there with our hands folded and wait for the for the miracle to occur. We go out, have a job. And when we do things in life, we do it prudently. There's a verse in Proverbs 28. Ashri Adam Mefachet Tomid. Happy is the person that always is afraid. Person should act prudently. Person realizes that we have accountability for our actions. God's not going to help us if we're foolish. Person has free will not to commit suicide. We have faith, but we also act. You know, it reminds me of I don't know if you're familiar with this. One of the major forms of music that came out in the 60s is folk music. It's been, to a sense, abandoned. This was the era that produced Bob Dylan, Pete Seeger. There was a professor in Harvard named Tom Lehrer, who came out with a record. There were several records that he came out with. Tremendous lyrics. He was a great satirist. One of his songs is called "The Bomb." There was a tremendous fear we had in the 1960s about the bomb. Remember that all those shelters that were built in the 60s. And it begins as first, "We have the bomb, but that was good because we stand for love and brotherhood." Then Russia got the bomb, but you needn't fear. The balance of powers. It says there's nothing to grieve because the balance of power is maintained that way. It goes on to say that then Britain got the bomb. It says then France got the bomb. You know, France got the bomb, but you needn't grieve. There are allies, I believe. Israel's getting tense. It's going to get one in self-defense. The Lord's our shepherd, that's our psalm, but just in case, better get a bomb. But that is our philosophy. The Lord is our shepherd. But we do act. We're God's partners in life. We go get jobs. We do take the job interview. We don't worry. We have the sense that we are cared for, but we go through the motions. And that's the A, is act. But unfortunately, very often we do get scared. We get desperate. And we try this and we try that, and we go to this psychic or to this, or we go... And the V is for voodoo. And even the best of us very often are gripped with this irrational fear and do rash things. And this is the story, you can look yourself, about King Saul, Shaul HaMelech, who before, this is the night before his last battle, he went to a medium to get some psychic relief. But the Jewish way is to do what's prudent, really, and to have faith. God put us here. He's concerned with us. And to the extent that we have faith, He is there for us. The E is excuses. Very often, the fears that we have are not real fears. They're excuses. There are the excuses of the, as King Solomon puts it, the way of the lazy man. We're required to take control of our lives. We're partners in this world. There's God, but there's man. And because of that, we have to act. And sometimes it's hard. We'd like the miracle to occur. We don't want to work. And because of that, we manufacture excuses. Or we manufacture worries. But it comes from a mindset that really, not so much of that there's really a worry. but rather that we're really afraid to exert control. Because after all, life is about God, life is about man. Part of the idea of stop worrying is taking control of our lives. We can't blame anyone else. Ultimately, God gave us free will, and he gave us the ability, and he says, I'm with you, but you've got to do it. So the first, the have, is what we went through, is the attitude. And the Jewish attitude is an attitude of hope. It's an attitude of faith. It's not a leap of faith. It's based on an awful lot of evidence. The evidence of the survival of the Jews, of the Torah. The evidence of all these people who have psychic experiences. The evidence of creation itself in DNA in the atom. And we have something to rely upon. This is the way the Jews have existed for thousands of years. This is the essence of Judaism, hope. That's the H. A, we have to act. We're God's partners. V, we shouldn't resort to the, what we call the ridiculous. We can create miracles if we have faith, we have prayer. And E is excuses. We shouldn't make our worries be the excuses for our laziness. We're very privileged to have the ability to exercise our free will. If we have that will, God's with us. The F is fate. And this is really something which is very important, the F together with A here, fate with afflictions. Is what part is God's, what part is ours? We're on this earth. God put us here. He's with us. He cares for us. To what extent do we have to worry? To what extent does God have to worry? And really, what sums up the Jewish view of life is on page 3 here. This is fate. Hakol bidei shamayim chutz miyira shamayim. Everything is in the hands of heaven except the fear of heaven. Basically, what God is telling us is, I'll take care of your business, I'll take care of your health, I'll take care of your marriage. You take care of yourself. I want you to become a better person. Our free will, that area that we exercise our free will, is to our relationship with God, our spirituality. That we have free will. Are we going to become good people? Are we going to become petty people? Are we going to become people who have a relationship with God or not? It's all up to us. God tells us, you take care of that. I'll worry about the rest. There are areas, of course, we can't commit suicide. This is the A. We're given free will to harm ourselves. We have to be prudent in life. We have to go through the steps. But ultimately, the Jewish view of life is, you go through the motions, but actively worry, be concerned about your spirituality, and I, God, will worry about the rest. That is the Jewish view. There is a place of worry. And we're going to discuss this in a second. But where we should worry is about our spirituality. That's something we can't control. If we decide to be better people, that's a decision we can make. No one's going to make us a better person. And if we decide to become petty people and small-minded people, that's our decision too. Those are the decisions God put in our hands. So I'd just like to summarize here before I just briefly go through the end of this. We began this lecture with great detail of how psychotherapy deals with worry. I feel it's very important to know. There are worries that we have that just don't go away by just philosophy. And sometimes we do have to go to a therapist. And sometimes we have to achieve this catharsis and confront our past. Sometimes we have to change our behavior. But whatever we do, we have to change the way we look at our future and our philosophy of life. And the Jewish philosophy of life is there's nothing to worry about except our own spirituality. That we should really worry about. Because we can change that. How that job interview will come out ultimately is in God's hands. If that elevator will snap or not, that's in God's hands. If we will be worry-free people, if we will be caring people, if we will be people with hope, that's something that only we can do. And that's something we really have to worry about. Again, F and A is fate and afflictions. There is fate. There are afflictions, but we do have control. We are given our bodies, tremendous responsibility for it. And we are given the ability to change ourselves. And that is probably that, with the idea that God takes care of us. This is really basically the two basic foundations of Judaism. We are not just animals of instinct. Our behavior just cannot be determined. We have free will. We can change ourselves. And God is with us. I is intuition. Sometimes we have irrational fears that grip us that are not so irrational after all. And this is the idea of having a premonition. There is a psychic side of us. In the book Many Lives, Many Masters, Dr. Weiss describes of what this woman said, that not only did she live these past lives, but she had, in a sense, these masters, these guardian angels, or these people that had lived previous lives that are there to help her. And they, in a sense, were the still small voice in her. There's a notion which we encounter in many places of the Talmud. Each one of us has a guardian angel. And if we have a premonition, it may not be that irrational. We have to check. It's not something that's occurred before. It's not a long-standing phobia. It's not a common worry that we have that we attribute to some psychological or some of the trauma of our childhood. It may very well be that there is something to it. When people fast, I mean, there is a tradition that if one has a disturbing dream, one fasts because of the possibility, maybe a remote possibility, but the possibility that it may be a psychic dream. There is a psychic world. And there is communication between us and that world. It's by and large blocked. Sometimes there's a small opening. So if you do have something which you've never had before, it may be prudent not to take it lightly. Again, I'm not dealing with a phobia. This is not a long-standing worry. You're a worrier. It's not something chronic. You just have something that doesn't feel good. Sometimes you may have to follow your feeling. And this is where worry really may be very positive. I'd like in conclusion to deal with something which is basic to Judaism. The basic premise of Judaism is God made us, He takes care of us, we are designed. Worry is a problem. We often ask ourselves, why should we have worries? It's just a nuisance. But everything that was created is there for a purpose. Worry is there for a purpose too. One, of course, is the worry of the rational fears that we prepare ourselves. It's like as we began the lecture, when the head of our units has fixed bayonets in charge, there's something to worry about. There's another worry, a real worry, and that's really what we do with our lives. And that's a worry that the Talmud explains is experienced by every Jew. In fact, the Talmud entertains the notion that the body temperature, the internal temperature of a Jew is different than a non-Jew, because Jews worry so much. But the worry here is not, again, about the elevator snapping or the job interview. It's the idea of life is a very serious matter. What am I going to do in the few short years that I have in life? Am I going to become a better person, a more spiritual person? I'm going to waste those years. And those are real worries. And that really is the intent of the verse. And if you look on page 4, what's called T, in Torah, is this verse, Ashrei Adam Mefached Tamid. Happy is the person who's always afraid. That's a real worry. And it's something we can do, we can handle, we can control. When we worry about if our job interview is going to go well, we can't control. We can control to a certain extent. Beyond that, that's not our control. To that extent, we have faith. To the extent, are we going to be better people, doesn't suffice to have faith. We have to really take ourselves, we have to take control of ourselves and really ask ourselves serious questions. Am I going to be a better person? Life is short. Am I really the husband that I or wife that I should be? Am I the parent that I should be? How can I fix myself up? Those are real worries. We deal with how to stop worrying is the Narishkeit. You know, are the worries that are beyond our control that we let God worry about. But the spiritual worries are worries that are good worries. That's why God gave us the ability to worry, because it motivates us to action. H, help, is the idea of how do you seek help. We began with the Freudian method of catharsis. We find a similar idea of how to deal with worry in the Talmud. According to one opinion, if you have worries, confide those worries to your friends. Speak it out. Express it. Don't keep it in. On one level, of course, could be the idea of catharsis. Once it's brought out, you see what it is. There's another idea of it's important to have friends. You shouldn't go through life alone. And there are two reasons that the commentaries explain why it's important to share our worries. One is that our friends see it at a different angle than we do. They're not caught up into it. They're less passionate. And they can often give you very good advice. We who are inside of it, who are troubled, who just can't see a way out. There's an expression in the Talmud, Ein chovish mater atzmo mibeis asurim. A prisoner can't free himself out of prison. You need someone on the outside to help you out. And the other is the idea of prayer. We spoke about the study, you know, in San Francisco of the 393 people. Ideally, we should pray for ourselves. Sometimes we're so wrapped up, we're so besides ourselves, we can't pray. If somebody else prays, it really helps. Because the idea of prayer is bringing God in our life. Nothing more, nothing less. We invite Him in. It's like the guy in the Grand Canyon who let go. We invite Him in. If we have worries, what should we do? The first thing is try to rethink life. To develop, to cultivate a philosophy of hope. God put us on this earth. He loves us. He's taken care of us till now. He'll take care of us further on. That's the basis of Judaism. We should cultivate that through prayer. And if that doesn't work, I mean, it works to a certain extent, but we still have those fears. We should share those fears. Don't keep it in. And if after sharing it with a friend and you still don't have relief, you should go to a therapist. You should go to a professional. You should go to someone who deals with fears on a day-to-day basis. And perhaps there's a root cause for this fear that he will be able to get out, that your friend won't be able to. Or perhaps it's important to go through behavior modification, to train yourself to be less fearful. But the basic philosophy of having hope is something that will be with you the rest of your life. It's something which adds pleasure to life. I mean, after all, you wake up in the morning and you have that sense, I'm not alone. You go through life and through the stress of jobs and marriage and children. You go through life with hope. How to stop worrying? The beginning is really how to analyze what life is all about. And to realize that there's really much to be thankful for. And throughout our lives, there's been a force that's been with us and hopefully will continue to be with us. Thank you. If you have any questions.
I just wanted to ask you, you speak about introspection and thinking. A lot of times thoughts are what gives us more anxiety.
The question was asked about that. I suggested that we need more introspection. But the question was, but often our thoughts give us more anxiety. The more we think, the more worried we get. So in a sense, you suggest that perhaps we should be numbed, so to speak. In other words, think less, and it's not going to be so bad. There are two kinds of worries we expressed before. There are worries that are things that are beyond our control. How is life going to end up? What's going to happen? These are worries that pain us. And this is the idea that the focus of the class was the importance of cultivating a spiritual view of life. That we're not alone in life. No, that God is with us. The reason, though, very often that we don't cultivate that kind of a life. Why aren't we more spiritual? Even people who attend shul, who go mouth it, who go through all the motions, and you look at them and they're really not very spiritual people. They're ritualistic people. As they go through the motions. They may very be concerned with the minutiae, you know, of legalisms or ritual, you know, halacha. But in terms of their religiosity, their faith, there's something very much lacking. And see, part of the problem is doing, as we're saying, that behavior modification, doing shapes our thinking. But ultimately, we have to think. If we go into a synagogue, we open a prayer book and just mouth prayers without thinking. It has some sort of an effect, but it's minimal. If on the other hand, we try to take grip of what is this all about? And what's life all about? And where am I headed in life? Ultimately, if a person comes as assuming, at least within his thoughts, that there is a designer of this world, that there is a creator, and realizing that the focus of where our life is headed is really not where if we would be asked, what should our life ideally be? What should the ideal person be? We'd fall very short of that. These are things we have to face, and it may be painful. But ultimately, when we come to grips with what's the purpose of life, what's life all about, and am I really living up to what I think should be the ideal? I think at the end of this whole process, I think it's very pleasant. Because at the end of the process, what you come up with is a different philosophy of life. That really, God is here, He's taking care of me, I can only do what I can do, not one ounce more, and He doesn't expect any more of me. I can only do my best and no more. And in that sense, you feel relief. Yes?
I can only tell you, Robert, I had been 40 years to son-in-law terminal here. And the Emuna has given for me and for my family the strength. And since then, and always, if I talk to you as a children, I always mention, Yeverechecha ve'ishmerechecha. And now I had a little marshal from my body. She told always, you have to give all, but to find not always the right person. So she told, go under a tree, tell everything what you want, the tree listen to you, you give it all, and don't say it for nobody. So this was a lecture from my body.
Okay. I was trying to understand, to incorporate the perspective you expressed tonight. I feel sometimes that there is a weakness with that, because you could always take in taking a perspective of hope, you can also take the perspective of evaluating the reality that is around you, the immensity of the cosmos, the fact that we look back into the cosmos and we see things that happened billions of years ago, and we see that things have continued for billions of years, a loss of nature have been basically steady for all those years. And in that context of extraordinary immensity, it seems that there is nothing new under the sun, so to speak, and your own personal hopes are overshadowed by that far more immense and overwhelming reality that you stare out, let's say, in the sky.
Let me answer this. It's a very profound question here, which has really been a contributing factor of why man looks at himself very much different than a medieval man. The question that George asked was that there's an immensity of the cosmos. According to the methodology we have to measure distances, we are dealing with billions and billions of light years. The Earth is a piece of dust in this vast cosmos. And there's a certain sense of that a person feels like nothing. So insignificant. And a person like, then my life is so insignificant. I mean, and how does one look at this greatness of the cosmos and then look at himself with a sense of importance and greatness? The answer I'm going to say that I'm going to articulate may sound a little difficult, but it's really on two parts. One is, philosophically, our notion of God is that God has no space. There's no space to God. God is not measured in billions of light years. If you have no space, if you're above space, then it doesn't make a difference if something is wide, billions of light years, or something is a speck. It's all the same. To God, there's no difference between us and the cosmos. Every particle of the cosmos is just as important or as part of it as another part. So, in a sense, we may be small compared to the cosmos, but in God's eyes, everything is small or as big relative to anything else. That's one thing. Second of all, which is at least important from a Jewish view, in this world, there are many ants, many amoeba, sponges, fish of all kinds. From the Jewish point of view, the important thing, though, is man. Man is what the whole creation is all about. Because man has the power to shape himself. You can shape your personality. You can go up and you go down. And that's very, very unique. The cosmos, maybe how many light years, but we, mankind, is the generator of the entire cosmos. If you just think about an analogy, there may be an entire computer complex. Maybe it's run by the Pentagon. It controls all of our defense systems. And ultimately, it's controlled by a switch. Little switch, it may cost 25 cents. That little switch controls everything. If someone flips that switch off, our whole, you know, I don't know how it's wired, but oh, theoretically, everything is shut down. Mankind is the switch of the cosmos. How big the cosmos may be, and how important one could argue about the importance of the cosmos, we are the generator. We are the switch. We are what it's all about. We may be small in size, but we can't underestimate our importance. And in that sense, we can't underestimate the importance of us becoming better people. Because to the extent that we become better people, more energy flows into those cosmos. If you have a light switch, you know, that you turn on the intensity, you know, that you turn it on and it gets brighter, you turn the other way and it gets dimmer. In a sense, we are that dimming switch. The more we turn ourselves on itself, the more light there is in the entire cosmos. We are very, very important. Okay.
Why worry?
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.